This episode is brought to you by Rock in Rio Lisboa, the sister event to Brazil's iconic music festival Rock in Rio. The Portuguese leg of the event is set to celebrate its 20th anniversary with one of its biggest editions yet, and over 80,000 attendees across its 4 days, of which some of them could be you. Taking place over 2 weekends this June, some of music's biggest names will be taking to the stage in Lisbon. We're talking Ed Sheeran, we're talking Doja Cat, even the Jonas Brothers are getting in on the action. And with each day specially curated by genre, there's literally something for everyone. I went to the town in Rio last year, which is curated by the same people as Rock in Rio, and it was, I'm going to say, one of the wildest festivals I've ever been to. This year's Rock in Rio Lisboa takes place on the 15th, 16th, 22nd and 23rd of June, and tickets can be purchased now via their website, rockinriolisboa.pt. Hello and welcome to Before They Knew Better, the podcast from DIY Magazine. My name is Lisa Wright. This is my co-host and producer, Giles Bidder.
Hello.
Thank you to all those who are returning for the second series. Hello to people that may be joining us for the first time. You've got 12 episodes in the bank to go back and listen to. But this episode is a cracker to kick off the second series with. C-Matt has had objectively a whirlwind, wild, wonderful year since the release of her second album, Crazy Mad For Me. We spoke to C-Matt in January, so a couple of months ago. It was just before she went to the Brit Awards and had, I would say, a pretty star-making moment thanks to a very revealing arse crack centric gown, which got her splashed all over the tabloids, and her bum got censored on various media outlets, much to her glee, I would say. We caught up with C-Matt before this moment of cultural history, and we spoke to her about her plans for the Brits, about all of her time growing up in Ireland, about her youth as a lovely little weirdo making clothes of her own, and loads of other things. Normally on this podcast, we would ask our guests to bring in one photo, one object and one song from their youth. And we did ask C-Matt to bring this in, but just to kick off season two in a suitably chaotic fashion for our guest, C-Matt has actually lost the photo that she was talking about with us. So please enjoy a completely different photo of her as, we're guessing, probably like a six-year-old being mad on a banister. Yeah, it's not the photo from this episode, but hey, bonus features. This is the first episode of season two of Before They Know Better. Please go back and listen to all of season one. There are plenty of excellent guests to dig into, and we have a whole other season of other excellent guests coming. It will be every Tuesday morning in all the places you get your podcasts for the next 12 weeks. But for now, let us hand over to our inaugural guest of season two, the one and only, truly inimitable, C-Matt.
I didn't go out a lot. I wasn't living that like Skins lifestyle or anything when I was a teenager. I maybe lived a bit of a train spotting lifestyle around 21, but like when I was a kid, I was actually really well behaved. Like I didn't do anything bold. But I was also a loner. Like I had a couple of friends in school who were nice to me in school, but like I didn't really hang out with them afterwards, do you know, that kind of way. So I did spend most of my time dressing up for myself. I actually had like a fashion blog at one point, which I deleted when I deleted all trace of from the internet when I was like 17. I was really embarrassed by it. And I'm annoyed now because I would love to read it because it was really lengthy. I wrote like really lengthy articles about like clothes and stuff and like underwear's outerwear trend and like wearing a bra over your like lace camisole. And I was like 12. Like I was basically just really good at regurgitating like in my own voice stuff that I'd read. Do you know what I mean? Like I don't really know if any of those were my actual opinions.
Did you used to wear a bra over your camisole as a 12-year-old?
I definitely tried it in the privacy of my bedroom. Like I definitely tried these things out. It wasn't as horny as it sounds. It's like, you know, just having, it's like layering, you know what I mean? Like it's not actually it's not like I wasn't like a you know, sexy baby or anything.
That's the kind of thing, if you were going to go to uni, like a pretty established uni for fashion, if you got like semi-good grades, but if you also had a folder of blog posts that you'd been writing for, at that point, 8 years, that puts you in fucking good stead, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I'm really fucking annoyed at myself because I deleted everything. I deleted everything because I had like, I was so cringed out by it when I was like 17, 18 later on, because at that point I decided I was in fact going to be an alternative indie folk musician and that everything I did had to be very serious and very dark and very, very depressing. So the fact that I think my logic was that the fact that there's anything that exists of me on the internet where I'm enjoying something like fashion, which is A, quite a feminine trait, but B, is like wrapped up in the evil web of capitalism, which I do not subscribe to in any way, shape or form. And I live outside of society, actually. You know, I was doing that thing. And I just deleted every trace. And what's annoying is a part of, and like, I can never prove this. Maybe if I found an old laptop or something at some point, if I really dug, but I used to write concurrently with the fashion blog. There was like this running bit that was for me and my four followers where I would do a comic strip every week made up of pictures of Paul McCartney, where I'd basically just stick pictures of Paul McCartney together and like write captions coming out of his mouth.
What sort of, as That's in like brilliant. Paul McCartney doing sketches or like what would he be up to?
No, it would be, it would
collages.
Be
collages. You were doing collages. You were like the Cold War Steve of fashion Beatles.
Yes, yes, exactly. So I would have, there'd be caption. I'd just like find a picture of him that I thought was funny and I'd put a caption to it. And then I'd maybe put a picture afterwards of him either contradicting himself or like having a conversation with another famous person, like Gordon Ramsay at one point. Like there was a thing going on between like Paul McCartney and Gordon Ramsay where they were having a conversation with each other about vegetarianism, because I was a staunch vegetarian as well. I was a militant staunch vegetarian in Dunboyne County Meath, which you can imagine didn't go down very well. I was such a staunch vegetarian for like 5 years, and then when I started drinking alcohol all the time, maybe when I was like 17, I'd get really drunk and I'd like storm into a McDonald's and beg for chicken nuggets. I'd beg for them. Yeah, please. And then I kind of got caught one day by this girl I was friends with on the internet, because we met up in the park in town. She's from Australia. And I was like slyly eating. I think I was eating chicken nuggets before she got there. And she met me earlier and was like, "You're eating chicken nuggets. I thought you were vegetarian." And I was like, "Ah!" I was caught.
I've been rumbled.
You are well ahead of your time. Writing blog posts, doing collages, being staunchly vegetarian. These are pretty strong characteristics.
Also, I would imagine characteristics that maybe didn't make you super popular at the time. Would that be?
No. No.
The best never are. We all know that.
I've gone through phases with this as an adult. Like when I came out of secondary school, when I first came out of secondary school, I was like, fuck all those people. They were so horrible to me. Everyone was so mean to me and everyone bullied me all the time and they were evil. And then I got a bit older and like I'd meet some of the people who I would have like accused of being horrible to me and they were so nice. And I was like, and this is before the CMAT thing. This is before any of the music. And I was like, oh, maybe I was just really fucking antisocial and used like the storyline of people bullying me as a scapegoat for why I spent 6 years in my bedroom. I actually think everyone in my school was very nice to me considering I was a total weirdo. Like, considering how odd I was, everyone was actually really, really nice. And I just think that I was the problem with me.
You know? As Taylor Swift would say, it's me.
Yeah.
So we are painting a picture of Dunboyne. What is that like as a place to grow up? Is it sort
Dunboyne
of yeah,
Cantonese.
A place where it is? Are there lots of kids? Are you sort of surrounded by anything creative? Like, what? How was that as a place to live as a young CMAT?
So I had an interesting one, which is that I actually was born in Dublin and I lived in Dublin, like in North County Dublin, until I was about 11. But I spent my like teenage years in Dunboyne, County Meath. So I went to secondary school in Dunboyne and we lived in Dunboyne for when I was a teenager. So I think that's why I'm from Dublin and I'll always say I'm like a dub, but I definitely think I'm from Dunboyne, County Meath, because that's where all those kind of really intense formative memories come from. And it's a village. It is like a village. But it's lucky in the sense it has a bus that goes into Dublin city centre, which basically none of the other villages do. So if you're from any of the other villages in County Meath, it's really difficult to get into like gigs, which was my number one obsession and focus and priority when I was a teenager for reasons that are now apparent. So, you know, it's a hard place to, I think it was difficult for me in some respects because it is a village and it has a village mentality and like there is a lot of teenagers, like there was a lot of people my age living there, definitely was crawling with people my age, and like they were very interested in the current version of popular culture and like going out and like drinking and like getting the shift and like fingering each other. And, you know, like I feel like a lot of the teenagers around me were very concerned with all the milestones of being a teenager, whereas I never liked being a teenager. It did not suit me. It was not for me. I always wanted to be an adult. Like I always wanted, even when I was a kid, I wanted to be an adult. I wanted to be a 40-year-old woman. And I still, like I'm 27 now and I still have that thing in me where I'm like, I get on really well with women that are in their like 50s. Like always.
Yeah.
So, and I have a lot of friends older than me.
What do you think that is? Do you think that's sort of like, I don't know, romanticising being a sort of old lady wafting around in velvet capes? Or is that sort of just never having really, I don't know, why do you think it is that you'll reach a peak in your 50s?
I mean, I don't think that 50 is old lady, I should say. I don't think that being 50 is an old lady. I see that as being a proper bona fide adult. I think when you're in your 40s and your 50s, you're like a proper bona fide adult. And there's a sense of like having your shit together. And there's a sense for me of like, I think it's being well read as well. I think I've always longed for a certain level of like intelligence. But not like, the thing is, because I don't really believe in intelligence as a blanket covering overall thing that you have. You either have it or you don't. I think people have intelligence in different pockets. But the thing that...
Emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
Street smarts.
Street smart.
Book smarts. Yes.
Cop on, which is something I severely lack and always have. I don't have any cop on.
What's cop on?
I suppose it's the Irish version of like common sense. Like being copped on to yourself, like have a bit cop on.
Yeah.
I've none. Oh, I've like none. I've no cop on.
What's an example? When has your lack of cop on caught you out?
Oh, every day of my life since I was born. Let me think of an example. I have bronchitis. Well, I don't have bronchitis. I had bronchitis and now I have a cough that won't go away. So I read on the internet that you could get, I read on the internet all these remedies to like get rid of it and just none of them worked, and so it's been 3 months and I just haven't gone to a doctor. And then this morning I got up and I had this is a terrible thing to admit, but my sister has an inhaler because she has asthma. Well, she doesn't have asthma. I actually don't know why she has a fucking inhaler. She doesn't have asthma, but she had all these inhalers in her room and she's moved to Australia now. So I just was like, oh, I'm just gonna start puffing an inhaler to get rid of my cough. And then I went into the pharmacy today and I was like, hey, I have this inhaler. Can I get a re-up on the prescription card? And she's like, I can't give you an inhaler. I was like, why? She was like, because you need a prescription. And I was like, oh, okay. And then she walked me by hand next door to a doctor's office. I'm in Paris, by the way. I'm in France. She walked me, like basically fucking held my hand like a child and walked me up the stairs to the doctor's office and was like, if you just wait here, they'll give you a prescription for an inhaler. And I was like, okay. And it's just situations like that I get myself into all the time where it's like, if I had a little bit of common sense, I could have seen all these things coming around the corner, but I didn't. And also then I just left the doctor's office because there's too many people there.
Speaking French as well?
Yeah, but that wouldn't have been a problem. You know, you can kind of vibe it out. Just like hold the inhaler, yeah, show the inhaler. You're like...
I had once in Italy, in Rome, and I'd had what I now know is a pilonidal cyst, which is something not very nice on your bottom.
Right.
And we were in Rome, and I was queued up for this pharmacy. It was a Saturday morning. It was just like a long queue. I was like, fuck, so much pain, I should add, like real pain, you know, in not a very nice part. And got to the front of this queue, and just kind of, they couldn't understand English. I couldn't understand Italian. Just pointing at my bum, and left empty-handed. And it's just like no shred of dignity left after that.
You won't have, to be honest. I had an issue not the last time I was in Paris, but I was here this time last year as well. I spend a lot of time here. And full disclosure, I really suffer from an immunity based concurrent thrush disorder. So my fanny, especially when I'm on tour, is always on fucking fire in not a good way. So I'm constantly having to look for thrush cream in different countries. And I think France is my favorite one because it's literally called creme vaginisme.
Creme vaginisme. So beautiful.
And I was like, mais oui.
Could you start an account reviewing all the thrush cream from around the world?
I will, actually. I'm going to purposely... I'll get one from Germany. Do you know what? I have been... And I know this has nothing to do with my childhood, but I have been silently reviewing all of the different healthcare systems around the world. And I gotta say, France is lit. I like the French style. Because it's not very, it's not very clinical, actually. It's like what happened to me this morning, where she just held my hand.
Oh, hand-holding.
And, doctor's personal office was just someone's house. It was just an apartment. And
are you sure it was a doctor?
Yeah, it had a...
just a lady taking your hand. She worked in the pharmacy. Market of the French vape system.
She worked in the pharmacy, so I trust her. She was working in the pharmacy, and then she held my hand and then knocked on the door next door and then walked me up a couple of flights of stairs and was like, lo, there you go. Creme vaginisme. Well, I need a l'inhaler. but yeah.
Nice.
I do like the idea of doing the tour. I mean, that's the sort of when people tell you to make TikTok content, I think what they want is you saying that in different languages, probably. Yeah. That's what.
Different brush cream.
That's what the internet. Different thrush creams, perfect. So going back to being a little version of yourself, I mean, the thing that seems to be a thread here is the internet, I would say. Putting things on the internet, expressing yourself on the internet, finding mates there, was that the key?
Yeah, I think if I was, if there was one thing about me that was smart... was that I did post a lot of things on the internet, but then I would always wipe it 2 years later, like clockwork. And I'm sure if anyone went for a dig, they could find, way back pages about stuff I was posting. I wasn't doing anything that messed up. It was just embarrassing for me. And I got really, I was as a kid, every single day I would tweet about Bombay Bicycle Club. Every single day for a period of 3 years.
I love this Bombay.
And I had two blogs about them. I had two Tumblr blogs about them. And one of them had 10,000 followers. In 2012 internet currency could have gotten me a fucking book deal, to be honest. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. What was separate? What was were they different formats or different hypotheses? What am I trying to say?
One was like a collaborative. One was like a collaborative fan fiction Tumblr, that was really done by my friends, but I was submitting to it as well, if I recall correctly. So I wasn't really super involved in one of them. But the one that I ran myself was called the Jamie McCall Appreciation Society, aka McCallers.tumblr.com. And it was literally just pictures of Bombay Bicycle Club. And I would Photoshop their heads onto the bodies of the members of One Direction and then write captions accordingly.
I mean, it's creative. It's maybe awkward now that you're having to play with them all the time. Like, do they remember it from back in the day?
Of course they remember it. I was like a thorn in their side. Of course they know who I am. Like, that is how... I mean, and this is a really interesting thing, and it really speaks to the power of the internet. But, like, if I had not been as intense a fan of Bombay Bicycle Club as I was, I don't think I would be in the music industry today. I don't, like, because, you know, access to people who are working class and not from posh backgrounds is a huge issue, right, in music. Like, it is, for me, one of the most glaringly fucking obvious things that's going on here. And I do think it's the reason that so much music today is so... I think there's a lot of really unthoughtful stuff going around. There's a lot of stuff that's deeply unthoughtful. Mm. And there's a lot of people who I meet. And I hate to say this, because I do my best to lift people up. And I also don't think that being posh negates that, you know, your music is bad. On the contrary, some of my favorite music is by posh people. But there is an omission, right? There's like a glaring gap in the music industry, and it is like poor people with interesting shit to say. And I would never class myself as poor, but, you know, like, we were not of... I actually didn't know that I was working class until I entered the music industry, I'll be honest with you. Like, I thought we were normal. And then, like, I got in and looked around and I was like, geez, how are you lads doing all this? And, like, someone is paying. And I didn't have that, obviously.
And that's the main thing, is like having parents or family who would pay for studio time, expensive. PR, expensive.
Or just your rent.
You know, I don't even think it's that insidious that we have. You know, I think that's a bit of a conversation, a part of the conversation that I always dislike. It's the fact that people are, you know, with... I don't want to bring up anyone specifically in conversation, but there's a band I'm thinking of specifically who are so, so wonderful and get a lot of flack at the moment because they are posh. And so people think as a result of that, their mom and their dad is paying for, you know, PR campaign. And like
the expensive
campaign
stuff.
And like, they're like, my dad is the head of, you know, BMG, and he's pulling all the strings to get me in here. I don't think it's that insidious. I literally think it's like rich people and kids that have a little bit more money are given the time and the freedom to work on their craft. So it could be a thing that they just like don't have to go to school for a year, or they don't have to go to work for a year. Like, I was working while I was in school, and then I was working immediately as I came out, and I was working in shops the whole time, because if I didn't have a job, my nanny would have maybe murdered me and put me on trial and then murdered me and maybe guillotined me. I don't know. Like, I would not have been allowed to do that. But having said that, like, there's also a thing where, like, if you are from a normal working class background, I didn't know anyone who did music. So it's not even that I was like, you know, around people when I was younger that I could see that they were doing something and I didn't have... I didn't meet anyone who played the fucking guitar until I was about 12. And I didn't meet anyone or ever know anyone who did music as a career until I, like, stalked Bombay Bicycle Club. And, like, they're such wonderful people, those guys. I will be, like, the biggest diehard fan of them until I die. Because, like, the way that I got in was, like, I obviously did my, like, little... learned how to play every Laura Marling song on the guitar from YouTube when I was 12.
Nice.
You know, tried to learn how to use Ableton. I have a theory that I was a better musician when I was a teenager than I am now, because I don't really do any of that stuff anymore. But
Fruity Loops.
Huh?
Fruity Loops.
No, I was Ableton girly. I was Ableton girly.
There we go.
I got an illegal download of a true LimeWorks, obviously. Sorry to people at Ableton. I pay for it now, I promise.
That's a pretty powerful tool to learn at that age.
Yeah, and I was crap at it. I don't have a producer's mind and I don't have a producer's attention span, but I was able to record myself, right? I was able to like get my ideas down. And then that transpired into me about 16, 17, making an anonymous SoundCloud account and posting my demos on the anonymous SoundCloud account. And the way that the internet used to work was that you could post a SoundCloud link, or you could post a YouTube link of a band you like, or you could just post a link, no caption, no nothing. And one of the 20 people that followed you would follow you very, very actively, because there wasn't a lot going on the internet. So they would copy this link and then they would paste it into a search bar, and then it would bring up the thing that was in it. There was no like clicking. There was no like clicking the link. It was like you had to copy and paste. And then those 20 people that followed you, every single one of them would watch it and then comment on it. And so I would post my anonymous SoundCloud links, or I'd post a link of Bombay Bicycle Club Live, or I'd post a link of whatever the Maccabees were doing, because I was also obsessed with them. And
yes.
Of course, I have taste. Maybe once a week I would post the video of the one Mahogany session that Everything did for Schooling in 2010, which is a video that I've watched so many hundreds and hundreds of times that is permanently ingrained into my brain, in the way that like Sky News banner is ingrained onto like the telly of an old elderly person. Do you know that way? It's like whispering in there, like, yeah. Brother, you look like the Taj Mahal. Yeah. You post a link like that, and everyone comment on it. So I posted my anonymous SoundCloud links, and then one day, Jamie McCall, who followed me out of like pity, DM'd me and replied to the SoundCloud link and was like, "Is this you?" And I was like,
and then, like, "How does he know?"
There was a part of me that was like, "No, it's not me." But I was like, "Yeah, it is me." I was like, "Yeah, it is me." And he was like, "This is really, really good." He was like, "This is genuinely very, very good. And I wouldn't say this, did I not mean it? Do you have any gigs coming up or anything like that? Da-da-da-da-da." And he pretty much single-handedly got me all of my first gigs and became my manager when I was like 17, 18 of my, like, I then formed a band. Became the manager of my band when I was 18 years old. And would help me like get over to London, like put me up. When I was 18, 19, I recorded loads of like demos with his dad, and I stayed in his like house, and he just like put me up in his house because he was like, "This bitch has got no money." She's got no
that
money.
That is great.
That is that,
yeah, that's genuinely amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And like Jack, okay. I remember Jack, who's the lead singer, like he was gone away. I think he was on a boat. I think he was like living on a cargo ship to like write music, which is actually relatable and maybe something I'll consider at some point in my life because I get really fucking distracted. But he went away in a cargo ship.
He went to India, didn't he?
Yeah. And and he basically, so then Jamie ended up not managing us forever because he was like, I'm not a manager. Like, I was just doing this happy hour. But then their manager ended up managing me, a guy called Jason, who I love so much. And Jack basically was just like, "Yeah, they can use my studio while I'm gone. It's no bother."
Excellent.
Like, it was not a big deal. Okay.
Fucking excellent.
And legitimately, like, and I cannot stress, like, I cannot more aggressively stress that if I didn't have those couple of opportunities when I was like 18, 19, I would not be a musician right now. Like, there's no, like, genuinely, I'm not trying to, like, I don't see a route for me had I not come into contact with them, with Bombay Bicycle Club. Like, there's no visible option that would have been open to me. Like, maybe open mics in Dublin, but then, like, who would have helped me learn how to produce music? Who would have helped me learn what I like and stuff? Like, I on that level, on that, like, very high professional level where it was, like, not just, like, some guy in a pub around the corner who was like, you know, maybe able to use a drum machine. It's like, this was my favorite band of all time and still is. And they were making a level of music. They were making music to a level that I wanted to make. And they showed me how to do that. Like,
that's amazing. And like, absolute mad props to them for sort of like spotting something and taking the time to nurture someone and to just be really generous about it.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's, I mean, I don't know whether that's rare, but it feels quite rare.
I've never heard of it happening for anyone else in the way that it happened for me. And like, it's definitely notable that like, I wasn't just a person that they spotted that had talent. I was a very annoying, very obsessive stalker and a weird, weird girl. Like, I was a freak. I used to stalk these people. Like, I can't imagine a situation where I would want to spend time with someone who is like that weird about me. You know what I mean? Like, I can't imagine a situation where I would. Well, I say that though. This is the thing. I say that where I'm like, I can't imagine a situation where I'd want to let a CMAP baby sleep over in my house to work on their music. I say that, and in the back of my head, I'm like, I probably would actually do that. And this thing, I probably would actually do that because they did it for me. Do you know?
Yeah, you got to pass it on now. Yeah. This is like the karmic baton. Yeah. Yeah. You have been asked to bring in a song, a photo, and an object from these times. We saw the photo. So, photo, little C Matt in a lovely, I mean, I'm going to say quite an advanced bit of dressmaking for a 12-year-old. Like, as I've tried making dresses, it's quite hard to make something that doesn't look like a sort of stitched together sack on you. And I would say that's got pizzazz.
Listen, so, I'm a fashion girly till the day I die.
Yeah, love it. When did that start? Were you like into sort of clothes and fashion and dressing up from when you were little?
Yeah, I love fashion. I loved fashion. This is mortifying. Like, I don't understand how I existed sometimes. Like, I genuinely don't understand how I came up with this shit. But like, I dressed up as Coco Chanel for Halloween when I was like 8 years old. And I remember getting really annoyed because my nanny, and this is another thing, is like, I lived with my grandparents, my nanny and granddad, for like 7 years on and off. Like, I spent a significant amount of time with them when I was like in my late teens, early 20s, because when I was a kid, they were the only people that would give me the time of day because everyone else is just like, here is fucking weird. But like, I dressed up as Coco Chanel for Halloween when I was 8. And I remember getting really annoyed because my nanny was like, oh, girl, she's so cute, little Audrey Hepburn. And I was like, nanny, I'm not Audrey Hepburn. I'm Coco Chanel.
Get it right, Nan. Jesus.
I was a real pretentious little fucking... I was so annoying. And the thing is, I say this...
How do you even know who Coco Chanel is when you're 8?
Because I watched a documentary about Coco Chanel when I was... I specifically sought it out with my nanny, probably. Probably with my nanny. I feel like my nanny encouraged a lot of this stuff, which is interesting because... And I don't think she'll mind me saying this. She's not a particularly, like, glamorous woman. She's a very practical lady, but I think she likes things that are old as well. I think, like, bog standard about me, if something is old, I'm like, hell yeah. I'm not a futurist. Mm-hmm. I'm not a modernist. I don't like things that are futuristic in any way, shape, or form. I don't even really like retrofuturism. I just like, you know, I like old things.
Can I ask how come you were living with your grandparents?
I moved in with them when I was 18 because it was very weird. I wonder, yeah, I can probably talk about this. So when I was 18, my dad, bless him, moved my family to Denmark on a whim. Because he got a job there and decided that we should all uproot our lives and move to Denmark literally the day after I finished secondary school. So we moved to Denmark and I was supposed to be there for like 2 years, 3 years minimum. And it turns out that like he basically moved us there in like a last ditch attempt to save his marriage with my mother. And that became very obvious when I was like living there. I was like, oh, so I left after about 4 months because it was a bad situation. It was really, really, really fucking shit crack. It was like, like a lot of crazy things going on. I also, you know, looking back on it at that time, you know, a lot of this is in my music and I feel like that's why I'm kind of okay talking about it in a non bombastic way, but that is also like when I developed my first very, very bad eating disorder. So I moved back to Dublin to be with my nanny and granddad because it just felt like a much better environment for me, you know, because they're fucking legends.
Stability.
Yeah.
18-year-old, you're a kid, you're a child.
Yeah. And I was a really sheltered 18-year-old as well because I'd spent 6 years indoors on the internet. So I moved back in with my nanny and granddad And yeah, we had great vibes.
Was it your nan that sort of like encouraged you to lean into those bits of your personality?
See, this is where we're going to run into problems, because my nanny at this moment in time currently likes to take credit for the genesis of CMAT in general. And her Instagram page is like a CMAT fan page, and like all of her, all of the pictures and all of the stuff she posts is basically just like, my CMAT, my granddaughter who I reared single-handedly, and like all of the pictures are of me. And that would be, that's really lovely, except she has like 16 other grandchildren. And so now there's like a bit of infighting going on, because she's like never acknowledged that. Like it's funny. Like it's funny. So I don't want to.
Are you making ground with the other grandparent, with the other grandkids, and being like, look, guys, just so you know, like we're all equal here.
I mean, they know. They know.
I do have a Brit nomination, so
I do. I do. I'm so sorry. And two number one albums.
Come on.
Sorry.
Loved your sincere Matt newsletter. I love your newsletters.
Thank you.
Because it's just, what a great way. Newsletters in writing. Hey, it's almost the very same as a blog post. It just, you have the freedom to write as much as you like, get as much character, personality in there, ruminations, put that on paper and share that with people. Yeah, I loved the Brit one because...
Thank you.
It made me think.
Thank you. Yeah, I really love the medium of the written word. And I feel like this is maybe showing what's behind the curtain or whatever, but I do not run my TikTok, right? I it's not for me. I can't do it. And I've also had to like... really heavily instruct my poor long-suffering social media wizard, Daphne Poon AWOL, love her, because she loves TikTok, and she'll be like, okay, so I've had, and it's really, I think they run it, like she runs it really, really well, because she basically, it's mostly just like videos that I record of myself, and then she edits them and then she puts them out, so there's not a lot being lost in communication or translation or anything. But sometimes she'll like do you know, videos where there's like poop emojis in them, and like, right, she'll say words like, she'll write captions like Swifty and words like this that I just wouldn't really use. But you know, it is what it is. And I understand that I have to technically appeal to the younger generation, because that is how this works. But that's not my language really. And that's not really what I do. So I love the newsletter because I love the written word. I think it's my favorite form of communication, and it's also the kind of stuff that I would have read when I was a teenager, when I wanted to be older. Do you know what I mean? Like, I mean my biggest number one forever and ever, amen till the day I die, is David Sedaris.
I love David Sedaris.
Yeah. And like, he's like, I feel like my approach to making music has been to be like the musical David Sedaris, where, you know, I'm trying not to concern myself with like facade or producing myself or producing my image. I really, that's like something I'm desperately trying to not do, even though I have this fucking long running joke of being an international pop sensation. It's obviously a joke, because I think I couldn't be anything further from an actual pop star, because I've been trying to be a normal person, or not a normal person, but at least be an honest person.
Well, I think what David Sedaris does so well is that he's a fly on the wall in these scenarios, and he's like an onlooker. And then through, we kind of live, he's the channel into Santaland Diaries, or... that, have you read the one where it's theft by finding? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh my God, it's brilliant, isn't it? And the way that he's able to be so honest,
yeah,
this absolute foundational comedy of like laughing and being appalled and thrilled all at the same time by everything around him.
And what I love about him is that he doesn't produce himself. And that's been a really important thing for me to learn about what not to do with myself. So what I mean is, like, the appeal of David Sedaris in the early years was that he was a fucking crackhead who was extremely poor and had to work in like Macy's as Santa's elf because he's quite short, and like he was broke, and he was like you know, had a terrible life at the time. And it was like, that was really gripping to read like first person perspective for someone who has that lifestyle, which I should say that era is something I've experienced myself. When I lived in Manchester for 2 years, I was basically doing all that. I was doing all the drugs and I was working in every shop you can possibly imagine, and was funnily having a terrible time. But now he's like a millionaire and he has 3 houses from his writing and he has a husband and he has a really happy life and he's like got a really good relationship with his like family. Mm-hmm. And he writes about that because that's what's going on in his life. He's not like, you know, pretending to be poor anymore or trying to be relatable. Mm-hmm. He doesn't try to be relatable. He just tries to be honest. And I think that I think about that a lot going forward with my work because, you know, my first 2 records are predominantly dealing with like my life before all of this happened, which was like crap. You know, so I worship him. I worship the ground that I'm on.
Yeah, and now you're just going to have to write like amazing albums about just being adored all the time. Like, is that going to be the third insufferable album of CMAT?
Yeah. Oh my God, it's so hard traveling the world. I'm not going to write a road album. I'm really going to try really hard not to write a road album because that's what everyone does. It's like, I'm on the road, I'm traveling through Chicago, and I'm just thinking about going back home. Like, you know, I'm going to try really hard not to do that, but probably
stick
will do
on
it
Spotify.
Because I love place names.
Okay, so we have veered into the present day, which is worth talking about, because by the time that this comes out, then the Brit will be decided. However, the nice thing is that that will always be a truth now. Even when you are 90, you will still have been nominated for a Brit Award, and no matter what happens, that can never be not true now, which is nice, I think.
I mean, guys, realistically, I'm definitely going to win. You know, looking at that, looking at that list of names, how could I not? Like, you know, Taylor who? Lana who? Lana Del who?
I know her. Yeah.
Kylie Mahoop?
Yeah.
I don't know.
The who?
What? I can't even who say are? That.
No, I can't. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Kylie, I love you so much. You're the most important person in my life, hands down by none.
How elevated do you feel by it? Are you floating?
I just feel like it's a joke that's gone too far. Like that is the only reaction I can have to all this. Because again, I am not a pop star actually, in the sense that I have no issue with putting my personal life out there, and I've no issue with putting who I am out there, because we're all gonna die eventually and it doesn't really matter in the long run. And I don't, you know, the really private stuff obviously I'm going to not put out there, because anything that's really private usually involves other people, and that's not my, you know, I don't want to be putting other people's stuff on blast. But I, as a result, like, I know that I am not a pop star. Like, I know this deeply, deeply within myself, because I do not do any of the things that all the other pop stars do. So me being nominated in a list that includes Miley Cyrus, Taylor Swift, Lana Del Rey, and Kylie Minogue feels like I've done a joke and now it's gone too far and now I can't like crawl back. And now I'm like, you know, and it's, you know, it's terrible, because being honest with you, getting nominated in a list like that, there was a part of me, like my instant gut reaction was like, oh my God, I have to lose a stone before I go to the Brits. Like, I have to, and I have to get, I have to get the fillers, and I have to get my teeth fixed, and I have to get extensions. I was like, you know, I was thinking about all these things that actual pop stars probably have to think about, like about my appearance, my physical appearance and the way I present myself, because obviously I love fashion, but I don't think that fashion and body image necessarily should be always linked. You know, I think you should be putting clothes on your body. You shouldn't be tailoring your body for clothes. But, you know, these are the thoughts that pop into my head when something like this happens, because it's nuts, because it's insane. It's like, why am I being put in this category? This makes no sense. Like,
you're being put in that category for being yourself and not acting the way you think that you should.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the thing, is like, you know, you'll have these thoughts because you're like, okay, I'm after being put in this thing, I have to do the thing that everyone else is doing now. But I had to take a breath and be like, no, calm the fuck down. You're fine.
Be that child in the photo dressing up in her thing that she made for herself because it makes her feel fabulous. I'm gonna mm-hmm. claw this back to the real conversation. We're doing it. Absolutely seamless segue. No, this is us. Okay, I just want to talk to you about the Brits because it's fun. But yeah, I mean, like,
and then I was body image.
No, but it's a real concern, isn't it? Because I think, like, you know, no matter how much you can feel sure in yourself and you can stand for these things and you can truly, truly believe them with every pore of your body, it's really hard to, like, not have that thing just flash in because it's everywhere and because it's scary being on the telly in front of loads of people. And I would imagine now you know what it is to sort of be in those situations and have loads of people pile in and just say, like, rude shit. And, like, I would imagine it's quite an experience, no matter how sturdy and hard and, you know, all that stuff you are.
Graham Norton was crazy. Like, you know, it's one of the best experiences of my life. And everyone there was so amazing. And, like, I really think we did one of the best gigs ever. Amazing. Right. Like, I really loved it. The comments that came. Like, and you know what's nice? It's like, it was only the day of, right? It's like, there was terrible, terrible comments the day of. And then now, after that, everyone's like, well, this is so amazing. And everyone's been really lovely. But, like, there was one guy who was like, wow, can't believe the BBC is promoting cellulite again by having these fatties on all the time. And I was like, what?
Oh, fuck off.
I was like, you people are nuts. You people are fucking crazy. You people are fucking crazy. You know, so you can understand why when I get nominated for something like a Brit Award, I'm like, okay, Bella Hadid, let's go. Bella Hadid. Like,
could you tell us about the objects that you've chosen? I'm aware we've got about 10 minutes left.
I didn't choose an object. I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. I don't have any. I don't have any possessions. I like live out of a suitcase, girl. Like, I don't.
Is there something that you remember from being little that was like maybe a Christmas present, a birthday present that was like a meaningful thing for you?
Yeah, there's a book that I still have that I was gifted when I was like 8, and I know I just packed up all of my belongings and they're in storage right now because I'm living in a suitcase. But one of the things I packed was a book that I literally got when I was 8 years old. Maybe I got it for my communion. Anyway, it's a book. It's a big hardcover book and it's called The Fantasy Encyclopedia. So it's like an encyclopedia of mythological creatures.
Nice.
And I deeply love it.
Did you have a favourite?
Probably the fairy godmother. I love the fairy godmother. I love all iterations of the fairy godmother. Love her. Also love like a nymph. Love like a water nymph. I'm a big fan of the as well. Yeah, but then also I'm a big fan of the golem, which is like it's like from Jewish mysticism. It's a story about like a rabbi who didn't have a son and he really wanted one, so he made one out of clay, and in order to make him live, he put like a scroll in his mouth, like a sacred scroll of like a piece of the Torah in his mouth, and then he was alive and he was like, I'm a real boy. But he had to take the scroll out of his mouth on the Sabbath so that he didn't work or live or do anything, otherwise he would turn to dust. And then he lived until he was about 13, and then one day he was out playing and then the sun came up and it was the Sabbath and he turned to dust and it was so sad.
Do you have any superstitions?
Honestly,
I think when you grow up reading things like that,
like I probably have loads of them because we are like Irish pagans. Do you know what I'm saying? Like my family is like only very gently Catholic, but we're quite pagan because my family's all from like Waterford. And like one example that I could think of off the top of my head is my poor cousin Rian. My cousin Rian is younger than me. I think he's 20, and we were at the pub the other day when I was in Ireland and he was just talking shite, but he was like, you know what, man? I have a fucking gambling problem. I have a gambling addiction. Like, I have a gambling problem. Like, do you know why I have a gambling problem? Because yous all used to make me scratch the scratch cards because I was lucky. So when, and that is actually true. Like when we were growing up, if anyone has ever gifted a scratch card, we just immediately hand it to Rian. Because he was the lucky one. And he fucking did win all the time. Like, it's not like he, like, I still believe it to this day. There is a part of me that's like, when I get a scratch card, I'm like, I should save this and give it to Rian. Because he'll probably win. But if I scratch it, I won't win. He was like 4 when this started. Like, he was 4. And it's like, he's now 20 and we still kind of do it to him. So maybe like that. Because I do genuinely believe
crippling debt from all of the scratch cards. Poor guy. Or is he retained his
luck? Actually have a gambling... He doesn't have a gambling problem. He's like a little bit of a he likes gambling, but he doesn't have like a problem. He's fine.
Everyone. He likes just loves a little though, acting. Didn't they?
Yeah, but he does like the accumulators on Bet365 and all that. You know what I'm saying?
Who do you support?
I'm not like sport. That's not for me. But I do support the women's Bohemians football team in Dublin City because it's just good vibes to be there. I'll be honest.
Yeah.
Like, it's not really so much a sporting thing. I'm not really supporting the sport. I'm just like supporting the vibes. And I love Boas. Dublin.
Are they playing your tunes over the people?
Yes, they are. They indeed are. Sorry, that was my cough that I don't have an inhaler
for. They should. When I was about 9, they had someone from our local SGR Colchester radio station come around to our school, and we all had, and they like picked a few of us to go and be on the radio to like talk about stuff, and we all had to do an intro, like a one line intro, and mine was, I don't support any football team, but I do support girl power. And to that day, I remember being mercilessly bullied by everyone at school for that line, but I stand by it, you know, it's fine, isn't it?
No, you're dead right. You're dead right. I take being a woman very seriously, and it's a great responsibility at all times. So I just think you're dead right.
Thank you. Thank you. My 9-year-old self was very, very right on. Anyway, that was your... So, fantasy books. I remember actually doing an interview with you ages ago when you were saying that you were, like, that when you were younger, you used to sort of just spend ages just sitting on the sofa, sort of, like... dreaming up little worlds and just would have like sort of just imagination would be a hobby almost. Which I actually think, I don't know, I think the way that you said it at the time was like, that was, I don't know, a bit maybe not embarrassing, but a sort of a sign of something lacking. Whereas like actually, I kind of think, I mean, that imagination served you well.
I still do that as well. I did another interview recently and he asked me what I did on holidays when I was a kid. And I was like, oh, I just like walk around the campsite and think. And he was like, what? It's like, yeah, I used to love to think and I used to love praying because I was a very religious child. I used to pray to God to bring me a boyfriend.
Using his talents like, very, very well there.
Please. And specifically, I wanted my boyfriend to be Nat Wolff from the Naked Brothers Band on Nickelodeon.
I don't remember that.
Okay.
What's the show? What's the show called? Yeah.
It's called the Naked Brothers Band. And I think it ran for like 1 or maybe 2 seasons.
Naked
it wasn't
Brothers.
A particularly the Naked Brothers Band. It was
because
not particularly
they were naked all the time.
No, I don't know why they were called the Naked Brothers Band, but they're basically like children who were trying to play music like the Beatles. And I think what's appealing about it is they did seem to write the music themselves and you kind of knew because it was a bit crap. So, yeah, I loved the Naked Brothers Band. The Naked Brothers, by the way, are both individually very, very good actors now. One of them was in Hereditary.
Oh, yeah.
It was like the younger one was in Hereditary as like the, you know.
I love those kinds of films.
Yeah,
they've evolved from nakedness.
Nat and Alex Wolff, and the other one was in
Alex
that.
Wolf.
The other one was in that terrible, terrible M. Night Shyamalan film called Old, where people went to a beach and it made them turn old.
Great film.
It's terrible. It's so bad.
Did you know that M. Night Shyamalan directed Stuart Little?
Yes, I did actually, and I. That's a masterpiece.
Great fact. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Fantastic
well,
stuff.
I guess, you know, people have layers, don't they? Layers and depths and little mice. So you were praying. Were you very religious sort of in general or did you only apply the religion when it came to trying to conjure yourself a boyfriend?
No, I think I was quite religious in general. I used to like I really didn't believe in dinosaurs. And it's weird because, to be honest, I don't know where this came from, because my mom and dad were like not that religious. And whenever I'd come out with something like dinosaurs didn't exist because God actually created the earth and the first people to exist were man and woman, and dinosaurs was just planted there as a lie to make people not believe in God. Like, I used to say things like that, and my dad would be like, "What are you talking about? Like, that is not true." And I'd be like, "But you brought us to mass. You bring us to mass and we go to mass. And that's what they said, and that's the truth." And he'd be like, "No, that's not true." And I'm like, I couldn't. Yeah, I couldn't wrap my head around it. So it took me a while to kind of get on board with science. Yeah. I'm still not 100% there, but I definitely, definitely think dinosaurs exist. Did. Okay.
So, which song have you chosen to bring for us today?
It is a song, quite poignantly, called Brown Girl in the Ring by Boney M.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah, aware of it.
I don't know it.
Always a song that I associate with my childhood, because my mom used to make me sing it and perform it to people at, like, you know, birthdays and parties. Like, they'd eventually put it on, and then I would be the Brown Girl in the Ring. Which is, you know, I didn't quite know what it was. I don't think I understood what was going on at all, but I do maintain that that's like one of the best songs I've ever heard in my life. And I love Boney M, and I love all of the work of Frank Farian, who died 2 days ago.
Oh,
he's dead. Rest in peace.
I feel like Boney M is one of those, like Rasputin, that was one of theirs, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Like one of those bands where maybe Belfast. Yeah, Daddy, I feel like they're not sort of regarded seriously in the sort of like music canon, but like actually, you know, as a songwriter yourself, what is it about Boney M that people need to sort of start acknowledging?
It's just great songwriting. It's just like, I particularly love Boney M because of all of the historical pop songs. So there's like Rasputin, which is like a dance pop disco number that's just a biography of Rasputin, which is so funny. And then as well, they did the exact same thing for Ma Baker, where they just tell the story of Ma Baker. Ma Baker, she taught her four sons. Ma Baker to handle a gun. Ma Baker, she never could cry. Ma Baker, but she knew how to die. And then also, like, they were really, you know, not to bring up the troubles of the 1970s, but they did release a disco pop dance number called Belfast, where they basically asked for the reunification of Ireland. And as a result of that, Boney M are like the highest selling band of all time in Ireland or something.
Oh, wow.
There's some crazy statistic where, like, I think they sold the most records. I think they've sold more records accumulatively in Ireland than like the Beatles.
The what? Oh, wow.
The who? The Beatles.
I thought you meant, than in the rest of the world, but more than the Beatles. Okay, bigger than the Beatles. Great.
I'm pretty confident. I could be getting that statistic wrong, but there's some crazy statistic about Boney M specifically in Ireland, mainly because they were calling for the reunification of Ireland in the 1970s, which A, was politically very poignant, but also at a time where record sales were at their highest ever of all time. So like the only thing people were doing was buying records, and then it's like German disco pop band who are all fucking amazing dancers. And you know, Ireland has a history of like show bands, right? Like we love someone who can dance and sing. It's like very important to us, and like someone who can put on a show. There's a man called Joe Dolan who's widely regarded as a saint in Ireland. And he passed away in 2007, but like the catchphrase with him was like, "There's no show like a Joe show." And he basically was like our Tom Jones, but way better. And Albert Hammond wrote loads of music for him. So he was like legit. Like he was like, he had really good stuff, but he would like fucking run around and do the splits and stuff. And Boney M have that, right? Because Bobby Farrell, who was the guy in Boney M, that was never his voice, that's Frank Farian's voice, so he was miming, but he was like an exotic dancer, and so Frank Farian just picked him up. He was an exotic dancer from Aruba, I think, and was in Berlin, and Frank Farian was like, yeah, do you want to be in a band? And he was like, yeah, go.
It goes
and, like,
deep.
Irish people love Bobby Farrell. Like, he has, you know, Bobby Farrell is like, he could probably get a statue in Dublin if we tried hard enough. Maybe I'll complain.
So that was C-Mat, wonderful C-Mat. We love her loads. We hope that you love C-Mat too. And we also hope that you want to carry on listening to this podcast. If you do, why not give us a subscribe? That means that we come straight into your podcast inbox on a Tuesday morning every week. You could give us a like as well. That'd be nice. And you could give us a review if you feel like it. That really helps, all of that nice stuff. While you're at it, why not go and check out the new issue of DIY Magazine? It has Bob Villain on the front cover. They are a very special punk band, I think, talking about how important it is to be, you know, to be angry and to be righteously angry, but also to look for the positives in life and to try and, you know, give that little bit of hope whilst you are fighting the good fight. That is out now. It is available to buy, it is available to read online, and it also has interviews with the likes of St. Vincent, Girl in Red, Lizzie McAlpine, bloody loads of great people. So yeah, give that a read, give this a like and subscribe, and we'll see you next week for episode 2 of the second series of Before They Knew Better with DIY.